All right, we should get going again. Can everybody hear me over there? Yes, still? And over here still, yes? Okay, our 10 minutes of fun, what we'll call the best part of class, is over. And we will get back to this other part of class, which is not so bad, right? It's like the second best part of class. So that's pretty good. You should never be sad about getting a silver medal. Silver medal is good. Actually, that's the most frustrating medal, it turns out. Gold, you did it. Bronze, you're like, thank goodness, I got a medal. Silver, you're like, if I had just trained, would have gotten the gold. So I recommend, are there any Olympians in the audience? No. Yes? Science Olympian, yes! Okay, that's not what I meant. But I appreciate that you're like, yes, represent. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the most basic, boring thing in the world, which is how do you represent like a number in a memory of a computer system? And what we found out, unfortunately, is that they're using this format that's a bit unpleasant for us, but it's not so terrible. So if we think about, let's say, a 4-bit binary number, 4 bits, remember 4 binary digits, we might think of that as x3, x2, x1, x0, where any x to the I can equal 0 or 1. And what we can do is we can very efficiently pack some numbers in there. In fact, I'm going to regret having 4 bits because I'm going to list out all the possibilities. So we've just lost a bit. It's a very sad world. Sometimes things don't turn out. So this is a 3-bit binary number now. And we're going to write out all the possibilities here just so we have a sense of how to do this. 000, 001, 010, 011, 100, 101, 110, and our old pal, 111. And as you can see, like I promised before, if we have n bits, what we can encode are 2 to the nth possibilities. And because we want information to be represented as densely as possible, that's, of course, what we're going to do. We're not going to use that silly ENIAC representation with, you know, 1 bit on means it's 10, the next bit on means it's 9, whatever, very like a sparse representation. And what decimal number are we going to represent over here? Well, we'll just do something very simple at first here. We'll just call it 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now, we're not worrying about things like negative numbers yet. We will. It turns out it's a little bit interesting how you represent a negative number in a computer system. But for now, we'll just do like all positive numbers. And of course, then you can, and I'm going to expect you to be able to do this. In fact, in a lot of classes that you take that are kind of low-level classes, you're kind of expected to deal with these kinds of numbers. You should be able to look at 101 and say, yeah, of course, that's 5. And the reason we can know that pretty easily is because essentially each bit, x2, x1, or x0, has a kind of a value to it that we can think of it as. We can think of this column as 2 to the 0, this column as 2 to the 1, and this column as 2 to the 2, or what we might call in normal person language 4, 2, or 1. And what we realize really all we're doing when we have this string of ones and zeros are saying when we're making some decimal number like 6, we're saying we need a 4 and a 2, but not a 1, right? So we need a 4 and a 2, that's 4 plus 2 is 6, but we don't need that one. But for 7, we need 4, 2, and 1. And for 5, for example, our old friend, we need a 4 and a 1, but not a 2. So this may be all review. If you know all this stuff, great. If you didn't know it, this is your opportunity to learn it. And that's a binary representation of decimal numbers. And you know, with binary numbers, you can do all the same things that you can do with decimal numbers. You can add them, for example. We'll talk about, like, for example, if you had 0, 1, 1 plus 0, 0, 1. So this is 3 plus 1, which we would very naturally go 4. But how that happens over here is we have 1 plus 1 is 0. We carry the 1, which is weird. 1 plus 1 is 0. We carry the 1, also weird. But then we end up with 1, 0, 0, which you can see is our friend 4. It works exactly the same way. And that's when we talk about an add instruction being executed. That's what the processor is doing. How it does that, it's kind of cool too. We're not going to talk about it. Okay, any question? Oh, let me leave that up for a second. Any questions about that? Make sense? You could do it. Somebody said, here's a number, turn it into its binary form. Here's a binary number, turn it into decimal form. No problem. Okay, you're going to be forced to do that on some homework. So we'll see if it's really true. Now, it turns out it's binary is what you might call a bit verbose for humans. Let me write that down. For people. It'll be very common that we deal with 32-bit numbers, and sometimes we'll deal with 64-bit numbers. It turns out modern computer systems often deal in 32-bit chunks or 64-bit chunks. We'll talk about why that is later on, but that's just true. And 32-bit numbers, this is a 32-bit number. 0011, 1001. You can see I'm really not very good at randomly generating numbers. It keeps going. 0000101111, and then maybe 0110. That's a 32-bit number. And if we always had to talk about that, it would drive us crazy. That's just too much writing for us. So people came up with more compact forms. The most common one that we'll see is hexadecimal. How many people have dealt with hexadecimal for something? Yeah? See, that's weird, right? You're in a group of people. Half the people have dealt with hexadecimal. That's already strange. But hex is pretty cool. It actually represents, with each character, a character that we're going to use to represent a number. Each character represents 16 different values from 0 to... Well, unfortunately, we don't have like a single character that goes for 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 in our normal numeric system. So we go through 0 through 15, but we have to represent them differently. So it's 0, 1, 2, up through 9, and then we just have A, B, C, D, E, and F. So A is 10, B is 11, C is 12, D is 13, 14, and 15. So that's hexadecimal format, and we'll often then go ahead and use hex to represent long strings of binary digits. And that's something you kind of have to get comfortable with too. We'll later deal with some programs that deal with bits, and we'll talk about bits, and we'll use hex values in those programs. And that's just something we're going to get used to. And in fact, hex, when you see a hex number in a program, it'll often be prepended in front of it will be this 0 and an x. And that's telling us it's a hex number. Like you might see an hex number, AAAA0000, for example. That's a perfectly good 32-bit hex number, okay? And we're going to have to get used to seeing numbers like that too, and we'll do that in some programs so you get used to it in a very hands-on way. In class, you know, I'm going to talk a lot. Sorry about that. Next week, we'll start trying to figure out how to have little breaks where you can actually do something during class. We're not going to do that today so much, so suffer with me a little bit. But then, of course, most of the work of learning is offline, doing assignments and so forth. We'll talk about those assignments and projects at the end of class today, but that's when you'll really get hands-on experience with all these things, and I'll force you to do a bunch of things that'll hopefully make you learn something about them. So any questions about hex? Hex is just another way to write down those same numbers. It's easy for us to see. It's much easier than seeing binary ones and zeros, but it's the same thing. So, for example, this is, you know, hex 3. This is hex 9, et cetera. This is hex F, right? That's an easy one. And you can translate the rest of them. Okay. Questions? All good? In fact, one of the things that you'll do as part of your homework, let's see if this works, is you'll run a little program called hex. These are little Python programs if you're a Python programmer. And what that does is it just creates some random numbers in decimal and then says translate them to binary and then into hex form. So you'll be forced to do this. And, you know, for example, here we can have the computer solve it for us. You can see those are some binary and hex representations of those numbers. And so a bunch of the homework problems that I assign are essentially will be randomly generated problems that you can then make sure you know how to do that sort of translation between, say, this is like the simplest kind of program you'd ever do, and we'll have more complex ones. Okay, so let's go back to this world. I'll show you how to run that kind of code and things like that offline. Okay, so we're trying to get towards a C program. What do we have so far? We have representation of numbers. I want to talk about one more thing before we get into bits of C code, which is the abstraction or the model we have of memory. We already talked about memory. It's where data and instructions live. But we have to talk a little bit more about memory in order to make sense of computer programs. And when you think about a C program and its accessing of data, what you're really thinking a lot about is, what is it doing? How is it accessing memory? Where is the data in memory? How am I accessing it? So what we're going to build up is an abstraction, which is just a fancy word for kind of like a model of memory, of a memory of a modern computer system. Memory is like the simplest thing in the world, actually, in terms of not the technology, but the abstraction that it presents to us, how we use it. And again, we're going to use one of our famous box diagrams. And I think of memory as just being a bunch of slots. These are slots. This is a slot. This is another slot down here. And what you can do is put information in those slots. So I can put some information in here, like I might put. And each slot that I'm going to talk about is going to be of a size of 8 bits, or what people call 1 byte. That's just a historical term. 8 bits is 1 byte. It's something you've got to just remember. If you already know it, great, probably you do. So each slot we can think of as being a byte in size, and each slot has a name. That name is a specific thing that we call it. It's an address. An address is just a name. That's all it is. And the addressing scheme here is very simple. It's the first thing in memory we call byte 0. The next one we call byte 1. Any guesses on the next one? No, it's 3. No, I'm kidding. It's 2. So anyway, it's 0, 1, 2, up to whatever the max size of the memory is. So if you have a modern memory system, there's something that might sit in byte 0. There might something sit in byte very much at the end of that memory. How much memory is in a modern system? When you buy a computer these days, right, how much memory do you get? 16 gigabytes, right? 16 billion, roughly, right, bytes of memory. So from 0 to 16 billion things we can put in this memory. Now, this is amazing to me. The first programs I wrote, they were for a machine with 16K memory, so roughly 16,000 bytes. Then it became millions of bytes, megabytes, then it became gigabytes, and that's kind of where we are right now. And, certainly there are systems out there that have terabytes of memory these days that you can go to Amazon, and if you've ever used a cloud to rent a computer, you can rent a machine with terabytes of memory. To the extent that I'm like, I don't believe it, but I think it's true. It's how big that is. So gigabytes is kind of a common amount, a huge amount of stuff. But the important thing is that each byte has an address, and that's how we can refer to those bytes. So if we have a number in here, like the number 10, and in address 3 we have the number 11, and the processor maybe wants to add those two together, it might want to say, I want to access memory element at 2 and memory element 3. It's going to get those values, maybe add them together, and then maybe store them at element 4, 21, or something like that. So that's what an address is. It's just this number, and it tells us which byte that we're interested in. And of course, we might be interested in a group of bytes. So we'll talk about later, sometimes we're going to maybe get 4 of these bytes at a time. That's 32 bits or 4 bytes. We might do that. But for now, let's just think of it as it's a byte addressable memory. Memory has operations that you can do on it. The operations are very simple. Like I said, memory abstraction is very simple. The operations are read, which you specify an address, and what that does is it gives you back the value or the data at that address. And sometimes we don't call it a read, sometimes called a load from memory, so you'll see those terms used interchangeably. A lot of what we struggle with in computer world or in any world that you deal with is terminology. It's not like somebody sat down and said, here is the terminology for all time. This will be very clear to you and consistent. There's a lot of inconsistencies. Like, for example, if you talk about a block on a disk, it means a different thing than a block on a flash-based SSD versus a block in memory. All those things are different kinds of blocks, even though it's like the same word. That's confusing. We'll find confusion like that all over the place. We just try to deal with it by calling it out. Here, when I talk about a read from memory or a load from memory, I'm really talking about the same thing. You can imagine if there's a read, there's another operation called a write. Write takes an address and a data value, and then what it does, you can see read returns this value. So like if I do a read of address 2, it's going to give me back the value 10. But what a write, like let's say I do a write to address 4, the value 21, for example, like I did here, that just updates the memory at that address to hold that value. That's going to be our model of memory. And when we're running a C program and we start putting data in memory, it's really going to be, we're going to be thinking about it at that level. And we're going to be able to do things in C programs that let us directly manipulate those bytes in memory. But this is what's going to be going on underneath of it. Okay, so it's a very simple model. Now, I said we have modern systems with gigabytes of memory. So any questions about that? Does that make sense? It's a very simple abstraction, just reads and writes. Okay, so I said that we have these machines with gigabytes of memory. And we said that the way we refer to memory is with an address. An address is just a number. Which byte are we interested in? Which slot of memory are we interested in? So the question then becomes, is given that we want to address, let's say we just want to address 4 gigabytes of memory. Let's say we have a machine, we bought it, it was a cheap machine. Today that's 4 gigabytes of memory maybe. So the question is, how many bits do you need in an address to refer to all 4 gigabytes? That's the type of question we should be able to answer when we're done with this class. In fact, when we're done with my next 6 sentences. So brace yourself. It's pretty exciting. And there's some things you should remember. Like we know, for example, to refer to, let's say we just had 4 bytes of memory. Okay? There's our little memory. You got ripped off. Your computer system only has 4 bytes of memory. Well, that means you have 4 addresses that you can generate. And they are 0, 1, 2, and 3. And so if you need to address just 4 things, you need 2 bits, right? You need 2 to the 2 gives us our 4. So if we have 2 bits, we can represent 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. Okay, 4-byte address, 4-byte memory, 2 bits of address are needed. If we had, these are just kind of numbers you should remember. If you had a 1 kilobyte address, 1,000 bytes, a kilobyte is 1,024 bytes. What's a good number to remember is a kilobyte is essentially 1,024 is 2 to the 10th, which means you need 10 bits to refer to 1,024-byte memory. Okay, so if we just had a kilobyte of memory, like that early machine I had 16 kilobytes of memory, so we would need 4 plus 10 or 14 bits. If you want to refer to a megabyte of memory, well, a megabyte is just, it's 1,024 times 1,024, or 2 to the 10th times 2 to the 10th, which is equal, if you remember how to do that, 2 to the 20th, which means you need 20 bits for a megabyte. You can guess where this is going. A gigabyte is 1,024 bytes times 1,024 bytes times 1,024 bytes. It's roughly a billion, right? This is roughly 1,000. This is roughly 1 million. And this is roughly 1 billion. And what this means is you need 30 bits to get to a gigabyte. And if we need 4 gigabytes, well, we need 2 more bits for each of those gigabytes. So plus 2 bits gets us to 32 bits are needed to address a 4 gigabyte memory. Now, some of you may have heard people talking about, hey, computers aren't 32 bits anymore. Now they have 64-bit computers, and that sounds cooler. The reason all that need arose was because suddenly they could build DRAMs that were bigger than 4 gigabytes. And if you want to be able to address more than 4 gigabytes, you need more than 32 bits. You need more bits. And so they said, let's go to a much bigger size of address, like a 64-bit address, which isn't often all used, but let's say we could use that. That means we can refer to many, 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 many more bits than the 4 gigabytes in our system, and that's why we moved to that next size. If that doesn't make sense, that's okay. We'll talk about that more later. Okay, so when we talk about gig memory and gigabytes and things like that, it's just trying to give you a sense of how many bits do we need to refer to all those gigabytes. If we have about 4 gigabytes of memory, we need 32 bits to refer to each of those bytes individually. Any questions about that? How comfortable are we with that? Like, totally comfortable, that's easy, or like, I already hate this class? That's the 2 ranges I'm giving you. Is there a happy ground in the middle, like that's okay? Is that okay? Any questions about it? Okay. Yeah. Yes. Sorry, I did skip. My teaching instinct was I did that too quickly. So I got to a gigabyte. So we got this part, right? Like I need 2 bits to get to 4, then 10 bits to get to a kilobyte, then 20 bits to get to a megabyte, then 30 bits I can describe 1 billion different things, or about a gigabyte. So I have 4 gigabytes. So anytime I need to get to, you know, 4 things, I just need 2 bits. So it's just those extra 2 bits give us, instead of 1 gigabyte, they give us this gigabyte, this gigabyte, this gigabyte, and this gigabyte. Good question. Okay. You can always ask later, too, if it doesn't make sense. We're not going to worry too much about that right now. It's just really what we need to understand is memory has a simple interface. It's basically what we call byte addressable. When we refer to an address, we're referring to a byte. Now, we're not referring to a specific bit. We could have had a bit addressable memory. Why is that? Why is it that we don't build bit addressable memories? We could. That would be perfectly fine. You could have a name for each bit, and you could say, I want this bit or this bit or this bit, and you could name each of those, and that would be 8 times as many addresses. So why don't we do that? Well, it certainly makes the addresses, you have to have a lot more bits for those. In fact, you need enough to refer to 8 bits instead of a byte, so you need a little bit more addressing. But it's just we have some efficiency things that we're worried about. When you get a lot of data at once from the memory system and you work on that, it turns out to be much more efficient than getting each bit and working on that. And it turns out many common things we do, in fact, we'll get a few bytes at a time. Like we get a number and we add it to another number. Those are many bytes. So it just turns out to be there's an efficiency reason, and we don't want to spend so many bits addressing things when most programs aren't doing bit manipulations. They're dealing with larger entities. If that doesn't make sense, that's okay, too. We'll come back to the details of that if at the very end of the course. Okay, so we have in our mind binary. Everything's binary. Everything's a bit. This amazing thing that computer systems are built of ones and zeros. Everything that you represent, everything you've ever downloaded, it's all represented somewhere in your computer memory as zeros and ones. Then we have some idea of what a memory is. Okay, it's just basically a bunch of slots with addresses from 0 to the max size of memory. So what we're going to start doing now is something a little bit more interesting, which is we're starting to think about C. C is my favorite programming language, period. I don't have anything else to say about that. It's a great programming language. In some ways, it's a simple language. But even the simplest of languages have a lot of details, things that if you don't pay attention to, you can get wrong. And C is not the safest of languages. If you read about security vulnerabilities in modern systems, some great number of them relate to the fact that a huge number of our computer systems are built in languages like C and its cousin C++. So why do those problems exist? It's because people make mistakes in their programs. And when they make mistakes in C, bad things happen, like the hackers take over all your computers, and you know your computers all become a botnet, which is then used to extort somebody or whatever. Who knows what's going on in the world? The world is so full of craziness, and this is, I guess, a particular apropos moment when people talk about hacking elections and things like that. Whether that happened or not, we never talk about politics in this class, so that's good. So I'm not talking about it, but I'm talking about it from the perspective of the reason these computer systems get hacked into does relate a bit to what we're going to learn about in class. So one thing we're going to try to learn about is what is hard about C programming, and how to avoid doing the things that lead to people hacking into the computer systems that you're building. Now, of course, if you're not writing code at that level, it's maybe less of an issue, but it's something we've got to worry about anyway. Okay, so we're going to start building up towards C, and we're going to try to figure out everything. Like I said, one of our goals here is that we're never going to show anything without it making sense. So we're going to start with something you know, which is we're going to start with numbers. Programs, like C programs, are filled with numbers, and you'll see these in the text of the page. You'll see numbers like our old buddy 5 again. You'll see 23. You'll see negative 6. You'll see hex digits like hex 10, for example. Hex 10, what's that equal to? Decimal 16, right? That's decimal 16 because it's, you know, we have 0 in the 0 to 15 column and then one of these 16s. So that's 16. If we had 2 0, it would be 32. So those are numbers. Numbers are going to be our most basic thing that we're going to deal with. In fact, what we're going to start with, just to make our life simple, is we're going to start with just whole numbers like this. We're not going to do decimals, you know, like fractional numbers or, you know, 6.5 yet. We'll do that later. We'll come back. That's a different type of thing that we're dealing with then. We'll start with whole numbers, and we'll go from, you know, from negative. We'll have negative numbers and positive. And amazingly, we will just call these integers. It's from the Latin word for whole. Okay, so we're starting with integers, from, you know, negative numbers to positive numbers. Now what we're going to see in a second is that our model of an integer, you can, in math, you can have a perfect model of something, right? You can say things like negative infinity, positive infinity. You can say very large numbers. It's going to be turn out in C, when we're dealing with C integers, that we can't say all those things. So we're going to have to learn what it means to talk about a C integer versus our idealized conception of an integer in our mathematical world. So we're going to build towards that. But to do anything with these numbers, we need first to understand operators. Operators are a very important thing to understand in any programming language. They're, of course, important in C. And we're going to start with some operators over the integers. What things can we do to integers? Of course, programs wouldn't be that interesting if they just had a bunch of integers in them. Like, okay, here's a bunch of numbers. That's not a very interesting program. We want to do things to those numbers. Like, if you're building a spreadsheet app, you might want to add a bunch of numbers together or divide by something or whatever. You can see I'm very imaginative in coming up with what programs do. I actually don't know what programs do. I, like, build systems, and so you end up spending all your time building, like, the infrastructure so other people can do good things with computers. It's a very strange world or business to be in. But in any case, that's the world we're going to be in. And what we're going to talk about are these operators that we have over integers. So what are some obvious ones? What can you imagine you could do with integers? So who's going to give the first obvious answer? You could divide them. Yes, you can divide them. Okay. That sounds like a very divisive answer. So what else? What else can you do? Add, I like it. What else? Multiply, okay. I think there's one more tricky one. There's actually two. Subtract. Oh, right. So that's an excellent point. So these are, what we've been listing so far are what we'll call, unfortunately, binary operators, which is confusing. But what they mean is that they have two entities that they're operating on. For example, when you say 3 plus 5, you're taking two things, so it's a binary operator. There are also what we'll call unary operators, which only need one entity. For example, negative 3, the minus sign there is it's a different kind of operator, actually. It's saying negate this value. So that's a unary operator. And of course, you can have plus. You can say plus 6. That's a unary operator. It's a subtlety, but it's actually a slight difference in the language. Now, we listed four of these binary operators that take two entities. But in integer world, in whole number world, there's one more operator. What's that? Yeah, mod, or remainder, or whatever you want to call it. You never thought after you got out of, like, third grade that you'd talk about remainders again. But here we are going back to the third grade. And honestly, wasn't that a simpler time? So let's talk about what that looks like in a computer program, and then we'll actually just look at some code, like the code fragments. So we have the operators here, and we just listed all of them. I'm just going to focus on the binary ones. The unary ones are kind of obvious, but they are, of course, plus, minus, times, divide, and then the remainder or modulo operator, which is a percent sign in C and in a lot of languages. So then we can write these things. It's kind of amazing what we can do now. Now we can start to write a little bit of a program, and what we're going to call it is an expression. Now, all these terms don't matter. They're made up. They don't really matter that much. They're just made up by people who know a lot about programming languages. They're a way to talk about the parts of a computer program. But we might have an expression like 3 plus 5. That's a perfectly good expression. And we know when we see that, we immediately think 8. And, of course, you might have another expression. You might have 6 plus 6 divided by 2. Now, this over here we know is 8. This is a little bit more tricky. Not really. This isn't really that tricky. We're not going to do anything complex math in here. So if you're thinking, do I have to remember the calculus I took way back when? No. We're going to have to remember things like addition and even maybe complicated multiplication, but nothing much more than that. But when we know when we're thinking about the value of this, we have to know a little bit about math. What do we have to know? Yeah, order of operations, right? There's some order that we do these in. And we call these rules precedence rules. And every programming language for its operators has rules of precedence. When you're giving a particular expression to it, it's the order that it's going to do the things within that expression. Fortunately, the people who are, you know, creating C as a language, and frankly most languages, they know that we have a natural kind of order or precedence for mathematics. So what is that precedence? Yeah, right, PEMDAS, right. I haven't heard that in a while. But what we can think about it here in this kind of restricted format, because we haven't introduced all those pieces, is that multiply and divide, and in fact remainder or mod, those have our higher precedence than, and this is lower, poor, you know, plussing, I'm going to call it plussing, addition and subtraction. So that's not too new to you, because you remember things like PEMDAS, and you remember all those great classes you took when you were a young person. So we know that when we see a divide thing, a sign, a divide symbol inside of this expression here, we know we're going to do this part first. And what we know then is we're going to say this is 3, and then we could say 6 plus 3 is 9. Of course, if we'd done it differently, we would get 6 plus 6, which is, if we just go in this direction, we go 6 plus 6, 12, divide by 2, and we get 6. So obviously the computer language has to know how to do this in order to get what the computer, the human being, expects out of it. And these precedence rules are how we're going to do it. Now, within a same level of precedence, we still have a bit of a question, which is how do we evaluate something like when they're at the same level of precedence. And in this case, in all these mathematical ones, we're going to go essentially left to right. So if we see like 8 times 3 divided by 2, the way we do that is we say 8 times 3, 24 divided by 2, 12. We just go left to right. We'll see that's not always the case for some operators. So that's precedence. It's easy so far. Precedence right now is easy. And you're like, why are you telling me this? It's boring. Could you stop boring me? And I want you to get those thoughts out of your head, mostly because that's kind of offensive to me, but I can kind of see it in your face. No, nobody's looking that way. What I mean more is that what we'll see later is there are some tricky cases where you're like, hey, I don't know what this operator, whether that one happens first or that one happens first. And you have to be very careful, and if you do it slightly wrong, the program might still run, it's just going to give you the wrong value. It's going to do the wrong thing. It's easy for math like this. It's harder when we get into some of the different operators. So we're just going to start with the simple things, and we'll build towards the more complex ones. So that's precedence, and we'll, again, keep track of that. Every time we add operators, we'll kind of come back and say, what precedence do they evaluate at? Okay, so let's one more comment about that. I'll kind of leave this as our first programming tip. We'll try to keep a bunch of these alive for us throughout the semester. When in doubt, what do you do when you don't understand the rules of precedence? You parenthesize, right? You can use parentheses to change the order of evaluation. For example, if I wanted 6 plus 6 to be evaluated first before getting divided by 2, I can throw some parentheses around it, and then what I'll get is we'll evaluate parentheses first, in fact, the inner to outer, and then we'll go ahead and do other things. So in that case, if we put this over here, we get 12 divided by 2, and we get a different answer over here. So if you want something to happen in a different order than what the natural precedence rules give you, just use parentheses in a way that's, I think, sensible. Okay, any questions about that? So pretty easy, I think, so far. So let's just look at a few expressions here. Okay. Now, one thing we're going to be dealing with, and you're going to have to deal with this in your projects and assignments, is at some point, there's a couple things you're going to need to learn that I'm not really going to teach in here. Unfortunately, we just kind of don't have the time to do it. And what that is one thing you're going to have to learn is some kind of code editing tool that's going to work inside of the context of this class. Kind of a classic Unix environment is what we're going to be inside of, so it would make a lot of sense, though you don't have to figure out how to use like a classic Unix tool like Emacs or Vim. If you're already familiar with those, great. If you're familiar with something else, you can try to figure out how to use that too. That's fine. We're not going to have a lot of time to figure that out for you. But part of this first week is you're going to just spend some time getting familiar with some editor if you're not already familiar with some. If you're already familiar with something, you can make it work in this class, that's great. And we can talk about details of that later or offline. The important thing for any one of you, if you want to be good at programming, is you have to be really good inside of at least one editor. It's like the most important thing you're doing as a programmer is you're typing as few things as possible to make the most code as possible. And if you're good at editing, you can move blocks of text around really quickly. If you've ever watched, has anybody ever watched one of these videos of somebody actually writing code who is like really good at writing code? Anybody watch one of those? I can see I'm going to have to force you to watch some code videos. And it's kind of amazing to watch because when you see somebody who's really good at using an editor, you're like, how did you do all those things by pressing like six buttons? It's impressive. And you learn by being around other people who are really good at editors. And being good at an editor is key to being good at as a programmer. Of course, you can type things really slowly and get the program right. But if you want to move large amounts of code around, you have to learn how to get around an editor. So what we're going to do is just look here at some int expressions. Can we read this? Is this big enough? Oh, no, I don't want to look at this one yet. I'm sorry, that's too fancy. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to look at this. This is a little program that just generates some expressions. Okay, and you can give it different random seeds, so it generates like a different set of expressions, like this, for example. And all these expressions are just ways for you to test, do I know how to evaluate an expression? It's not supposed to be hard. I'll give you this code so you can run it yourself. It's kind of like a homework assignment. It won't be something necessarily that's something you'll find challenging. But it's something you should understand. You should, of course, be able to look at code and know what this kind of expression should be able to give you. Okay, so I don't think we want to look at a specific... Oh, I wanted to look at one specific example. So here is one specific example. 58, 38. Different random seeds allow these programs to randomly generate different expressions. That's how I kind of wrote them. And this example here, well, they're all kind of easy is why I picked this one example. So you can see here we have 9 plus 3. We do that first. It's inside of parentheses. That's 12 minus 8. What's the answer? 4. Here we have 8 minus 9, negative 1 plus 5. That's 4. You can see how these are all going to turn out. 10 times 8... plus 4, 84, 4 mod that is 4, it turns out. 4 minus 10 plus 10 is 4. And you can imagine what this last one is. Yes, it's also 4. So these all evaluate to 4. So in any case, that's not particularly interesting, but it's just the type of thing you should be able to look at and understand. So that's one example of integer expressions. Okay, so not too exciting. What we're going to do now is we're going to look at a different piece of code. And that code looks like this. It's just some expressions, again, and we're just going to essentially print out these values. And what we have on the left here is we have the number, you can see, it's hard to see here, but if you look here, you can see 3 zeros, so 1,000, 3 more zeros, 1,000,000, and then 2 more zeros, so like 100 million is 1, and then 10 times that is 1,000,000,000, right? So 10 times this, if we print out this expression, we should see 1,000,000,000. If we print out 20 times this number, we should see 2,000,000,000. And if we print out 30 times this number, we'd kind of expect to see 3,000,000,000. But if we run this piece of code, if we evaluate these expressions, and I have this little program I wrote, you don't have to know how this works, but it's just called, it's a little Python script which does all the stuff. It puts this little expressions into a C program and then essentially evaluates them, shows you the values of them. Well, this doesn't do anything here. Sorry. There we go. No. There we go. Okay. Sorry. The details of why I'm doing this, it doesn't matter that much. But what we want to, if we give the dash C flag here to this little program, what this is going to do is going to print out these values. So again, what we'd expect? We expected to see 100 million printed out here. We'll expect 1,000,000,000, 2,000,000,000, and 3,000,000,000. Now, probably the case that if I'm showing you this, it's not going to be as expected. Right? Why am I showing you this otherwise? So let's take a look at what happens. And what you can see happened here is that the difference between an integer as we know it in the mathematical world and a C int, or an integer in the C world. Because it turns out in C, and I'm going to switch back, so you can see it looks like a big negative value. It turns out C, an integer, is a limited thing. So let's talk a little bit about how limited C integers are. Let me go over here for that. And I guess we can think of that as like a law of knowledge that we have here, is that a C int is not a, mathematical pure I have to think of a more catchy phrasing here, is not a mathematical pure integer. It's limited. And if you're writing C programs and you do not know this, very bad things will happen. You can lead your program into what's called undefined behavior. You can lead into things like security checks actually being optimized out by a very smart compiler that says, this code doesn't even need to run because it's undefined, because it's dealing with integers that are larger than it can be represented, and therefore I'm going to remove this code from your program and run that, and then all sorts of security problems actually arise because people don't understand this very simple thing, that you have to be very careful with cints. That's different than just an integer. If you're not careful, your code's going to break. So let's think about what we're going to understand now is we're going to understand in the next few minutes here, we're going to understand exactly what's going on with that, and then we're going to probably take a break again because I think I keep going on way too, this class is going a little slower than I'm planning on it, but that's okay. Okay, so cint. Typically, this is a 4-byte entity, or what we would think of as 32 bits. It's actually not always that, but it basically is on every platform that we're going to look at. And then what we have the question of is in these 32 bits, how do we represent integers? How do we represent some subset of the integers that, you know, most programs are going to be happy with? The problem we have is we have to represent positive and negative numbers. And, of course, one other number, our old friend zero, an invention in and of itself. We have to represent zero, too. So what we're going to do now is take a stab at that. We're going to kind of do it in a bad way. We're going to represent an integer in a bad way. And then we're going to talk about the way that's actually represented, which, again, was suggested years ago by von Neumann in his very early treatise on computer systems. And it's kind of a clever encoding. Okay, so how might we do it? This is like how I would have done it. Let's say we had, let's say we had 3 bits. So instead of real numbers, real ints are going to be 32 bits. In class, I'll always do smaller examples so we can kind of make sense of them more, okay? So let's say we had just 3 bits and not 32 for the sake of an example. So we can think of x2, x1, and x0 as our bits. And we want to, because we have 3 bits, how many total numbers can we represent even? Well, we have 2 to the 3 possibilities, right? So there's 2 to the 3 possibilities, or we have essentially 8 numbers that we can represent. Okay, great. So we have 8 numbers we can represent. But we want to represent some positive ones and some negative ones. So pretty natural what might be is we might represent from -4 to 3, or we might represent from -3 to 4. Okay, because 0's in there, it's going to be a little bit asymmetric, right? If we went from 4 to -4 and we had 0 in the middle, that's 9 different numbers. We don't have enough space for that in our limited 3 bits. So we can just go from -3 to 4 and -4 to 3. Does that make sense? Okay. So how do we represent those things? Well, it turns out like the positive ones, those are always easy. Positive or easy. We'll make the first bit 0, and we'll essentially call this, we'll kind of think of this as like a sign bit. If it's 0, we can think of the number as positive. And if it's 1, we'll think of it as negative. So if we're representing positive numbers, let's in fact do this representation here. What we can think of is, well, 0, let's say we're representing 1, we might say 0, 1. And if we're representing 2, we might say this. And then you can see how we run out of bits. 0, 1, 1 is 3, and we're kind of stuck. Can't make any more positive numbers because we've said that first bit, we're kind of reserving that for a sign of some kind. Now, 0, so these are our positive numbers, positive 1, 2, and 3. 0, we're going to maybe represent this way, 0. But it turns out it gets a little tricky with negative numbers. How do you represent them? So what might you do? You might, for example, say, well, when the first bit is 1, and then we just use, that's a negative number, and then we just use the same kind of encoding that we had here. So let's say we're trying to represent -1 like this, -2 like this, and -3 like this. Now, it's already kind of weird already because, well, we haven't talked about this number here. And if you kind of look at this, because we said this is the sign bit, this is kind of looks like -0. So it's already kind of weird that we've the way we've done this. It's like we made 2 zeros. And you can imagine why that's bad for a computer system. It's bad for a computer system because sometimes a program might want to do something like, say, is this number equal to this number? It's going to want to look at those two bit patterns and say, are they the same? And if we have an encoding that represents two different forms of zero, our computer has to be more complicated to actually recognize that as the same. We have an even kind of worse problem with this encoding that I just made up, which we'll call my bad encoding, which is, let's say we add a couple numbers together. Let's say we want to add positive 1 and negative 1. No, let's say negative 2 or something like that. That's 0, 0, 1, and negative 2 looks like 1, 1, 0. So if we were just doing kind of like, we just want to add those two numbers together, we'd like it to be that when we add the binary together, that it kind of does the right thing. But when we add these two numbers together, we get 1 plus 0, 0, 1 plus 0, 0, 1 plus 0 is 1, we get 1, 1, 1. And it says that 1 plus negative 2 is equal to negative 3, which is wrong, right? This is wrong. So we need to, it turns out it's like a little bit of an interesting problem. How do you encode the numbers so that when you kind of add them together, you don't have to do anything complicated, they just kind of works. And fortunately, long ago, people solved that problem. And I'm going to show you the first kind of little detailed thing that's kind of interesting about C programs, in fact, virtually all modern system, which is called a 2's complement encoding. That's an old name for this encoding. And this is kind of a detailed thing I will show you now, and then we'll take another break, okay? So we can kind of think about this over break. And let's just say, again, assume we have these three bits instead of the full 32, but the idea is the same. This is just for our example. What we're going to do is, again, here's all our bits, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. If you do this a lot, you get used. You feel like that's all your life is doing is writing out all the possibilities of this. And then the decimal value that we're going to represent over here, well, this is going to be 0, this is going to be 1, this is going to be 2, and this is going to be 3. But what we're going to flip is how we encode the negative numbers. And this is kind of this cool thing. This is this 2's complement encoding. We're going to encode them like this. So we're going to say when we see the bit pattern 100, that actually represents negative 4. And when we see 101, it's negative 3, 110, negative 2, and then 111 is negative 1. And this kind of cool thing happens, that if I did that same problem, like I remember I wanted to add 1 plus negative 2, right? We know that should be negative 1, right? If I did this correctly, what we'll see is over here, 110, you see 1. Oh, I should do a better, you know, it's a simpler example for you to understand. Let me do 2 plus negative 1. This one takes a little bit of understanding. So 2 plus negative 1 we know is going to be 1. And so if we do 2, we have 0, 1, 0, and then negative 1 is 1, 1, 1. And so when we add these two representations together, we get 0 plus 1 is 1. We get 1 plus 1 is 0, carry the 1. 1 plus 0 is carry the 1. And then there's another one that gets carried, but we actually just discard it. So we ignore this. What we're left with is 1, and you can see that's the kind of answer we expect when we add these two together. It's a little more complicated with that other example. I'll explain that later. So that's this kind of cool encoding that if you look at a C integer in your program and you look at the bit pattern that it represents, if it's positive, it'll look kind of like what you expect. It'll look like a bunch of bits like we've been adding up. But if it's negative, it'll be encoded in this way that's called 2's complement. And what 2's complement does is it allows basically basic math to work. And that has to do with the properties of mathematics and kind of the modulo of this space. We're not going to exactly talk about why. You can read about that. It's pretty neat. But we'll just have to know about that as a C programmer for now. We'll talk later on. If it's important, we'll talk about why. But mostly I'll let you read about how that works offline. Okay, so that's a detail. Why don't you think about that? Let's take another break. Let's make this break a little shorter, like 7 minutes or something like that, 8 minutes. So let's get back at 7:30, and then we'll just kind of go to the end for today. So take a break, think if this makes any sense, and we'll get into some more complicated C programs shortly.